Tonight, I'm happy to welcome Jackie Kramer here, back to Many Rivers Books and Tea. Jackie is interested in bridging the gap between the somewhat ascetic and renunciate inclinations of Buddhism and the secular orientation of our own culture. And tonight she'll be speaking about the Eightfold Path and the Kitchen Sink, the path of mothering and homemaking. Thank you for coming back to Many Rivers.
Thank you. Thank you, Jim. I love being here. And my two favorite things in one place, tea and books, you know. So I always end up spending more than I ever make here, but that's cool. I mean, look at this place. Look at all those colors. I was sitting back there where you're sitting, looking at the teapots. Aren't they beautiful? Oh, it's wonderful. So welcome. Thank you for coming out tonight and exploring what I find a really interesting topic, and I hope you will too. And it's a very exciting time for the whole world right now. Everything's in transformation, and Buddhism as well as everything else. And it's really, I was thinking about it, it's just, we are at the epicenter of thought here in Northern California. You don't realize it until you get outside of here. But, and Sebastopol is the center of the epicenter. Yeah. Isn't it?
It's and Many Rivers Books and Tea.
It's the center of the center of the epicenter. It is, it is. You know, I always felt an urging to go north, young woman. And you know, it all makes starting to unfold and make sense. And so I'm very, very happy to be here and very happy to share this moment with you tonight. And I would like to just start by sharing the merit of all that goes on here with all sentient beings, which is a traditional Buddhist opening to any kind of Dharma sharing. So I'd like to start by reading a quote by Tara. And when Tara was close to enlightenment, she was offered the opportunity to transform into a man in order to achieve full parinibbana. She chose instead to become enlightened in the form of a woman, saying, "In this life there is no such distinction as male and female, neither of self-identity, a person, nor any perception of such. And therefore, attachment to ideas of male and female is quite worthless. Weak-minded worldlings," I love that, weak-minded worldlings, "are always deluded by this." She then vowed to become enlightened in a female form because there are so many who wish to gain enlightenment in a man's form, and there are but few who wish to work for the welfare of sentient beings in a female form of a woman. I think that is so interesting, and that's very pivotal for women Buddhists in the West today, that is kind of the opening which we come through. Tara is the opening which feminine spirituality in Buddhism comes through, just as it is Mary in Christianity, or maybe Sophia in Judaism. So if indeed, and I believe it's true, in ultimate reality, there is no male or female, why would we need teachings specifically geared for women? And that's a question that has been something I've thought a lot about. And at first I resisted specifically female teachings, thinking, you know, Dharma is Dharma, enlightenment is enlightenment. And we don't need something, we don't need more duality and divisiveness. Ultimately, awakening is awakening, and that's just true. And within awakening, there is no male or female. Yet, When the Buddha was alive, he taught for 45 years. And he would, whatever people he came to teach, he used the metaphors that would relate to them. So when he would talk to ox herders, he would use the yoke and the ox as metaphors so that they could understand. And when he would talk to business people, he would speak in metaphors that related to business. And when he talked to, there's a famous story, the guy's name is, I can always forget it, Angulimala, and he was a robber. He was a thief. He was a very famous thief. Do you know that story? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when he taught him, the robber monk, Buddhism, he trained him to rob his... He said, well, what are you good at? He said, well, I'm not good at anything and except for robbery. And he said, well, rob your thoughts. So Buddhism has an intrinsic history of gearing the teachings for specific groups and ways of thinking and people. And so there is precedence for taking the teachings and having them relate specifically to the female experience. And the female experience is decidedly different than the male experience. We have different brains, different sized brains, different hormones, different organs. It's a completely different experience to be born in a female form. And yet, there are precious few stories and teachings that relate to the female experience and that speak to the female heart. We can find them. You know, I mean, there's women out there hunting, and I'm one of them, always hunting for good stories of women warriors, women healers, women mystics. But traditionally and throughout history, the stories were not written down for a number of reasons. And they were not honored. And all of the traditions, Judaism, I'm reading a book right now about Jewish prayers. Very, very, you've got to like really peck and scrap to find women Jewish prayers. The women weren't taught Hebrew, so the prayers were in Yiddish, and so that wasn't until the 17th, 18th century where we start getting female prayers in Judaism. And, of course, it's the same with Buddhism. There are precedents of enlightened women teachers. Mostly, when the Buddha started teaching, he established an order of nuns, and there's the Theragatha, which is their stories, their poems of enlightenment, in which they, in poetry, they express the moment that they became enlightened. And then there's this huge gap, and in the Theravadan traditions from which I hail, that's kind of it. That's kind of the Theragatha is a, I mean, there's just not. But then you go into Tibet and you get Tara and you get teachers like Machi Lobtrum, who was interestingly, there was a Indian teacher who died and was reborn, chose to be reborn as a woman and become enlightened as a woman, just as with the story of Tara. And so she developed the Chud practice and is very famous in Tibet as a teacher, as starting that school. And then there's, of course, Kuan Yin, who was both a historical princess in China and a mythological creation. So there's not much in there for women to find inspiration for their own brand of enlightenment. And then when you get down to mothers, it's even scanter. You know, it's just, I have been pecking and scratching for 30 years, literally, for stories from all religions of mothers who became enlightened within the context of mothering and homemaking. And now here's the exciting part that I find incredibly exciting. And that is that we are coming into a new age of spirituality for Buddhism and for everything. And at this juncture, feminism of the West is starting to inform all of the different religious traditions. We are making new stories. We are finding new models and new mythology. And part of that is that's very interesting, is that I was in Thailand in March, and there was an Outstanding Women in Buddhism award ceremony that I went to, and the women from the West were coming back to the, were being called to the East to reinform Buddhism, to reinvigorate and rewater the practice there in Asia. And right now, a lot of books, my book included, are being translated in Asian countries. And I was curious why they would possibly want to do, I mean, a Buddhist book by a Westerner, you know. And it's because a lot of the wells are drying up, and a lot of it has to do with the overly masculinization of Buddhism in the East. So it's a very exciting time for Buddhism right now, where things are being reinformed, and something, a whole new genre. And you'd think that by the 21st century there wouldn't be more pioneering territory or genre, but there is. And it's the territory of women's spiritual experience. Now, it is most chronicled in indigenous populations, but it is not, but in the Abrahamic religions and in the Asian religions, it's we're moving into a whole new territory. So I find that very, very exciting and hopeful, and I'm always encouraging my students, like, to make their life into their laboratories, make stories, make their own. We have to make our own stories for our daughters and our daughters' daughters. So my focus in this particular process is transforming the Buddhist teachings specifically for mothers, literal mothers, not great mothers or mother goddesses, but mothers in the home, washing the dishes, cleaning the hinies, doing the laundry, driving the kids to school, mothers that are today's mothers. How do we translate the Buddhist teachings into something that is actually useful and supportive of them? First of all, I want to say that I tread very carefully on this territory, because whenever you translate, you want, if you're a translator, which I view myself as, you want to stay true to the spirit of the original teachings. So that's where Theravadin comes in very handy for me, because they try to go back as close as they can to the original teachings. I try very, very hard to maintain the spirit of the Buddhist teachings, but willing to eliminate the cultural overlays that through the years have been put over it. And even in the time that the Buddha taught, he was constrained by the culture that he lived in. He went as far as he could. The fact that he took women into his order was revolutionary at the time. So he really stuck his neck out for women. But then it got like put to sleep. It didn't go further than that, except for a little bit in Tibet and places. So, what does it look like? I imagine with you tonight, to take the Buddha's teachings for women, specifically women. There are fathers too, but specifically women who are mothers. One of the first things that I think is really valuable is developing a home-based religion, which the Jews had to do after the destruction of the first temple. So, in other words, not basing our spiritual recharging, if you will, on a church or temple or monastery, but finding a way to make our homes holy places. Because it's very, very hard for women and mothers to get out of the house. I have students all over the world, and even if they have Buddhist temples or monasteries or communities by them, they have to get a babysitter. They have to, you know, it's hard to get there. And then if they bring their kid, the kid is a nuisance to the, it's not integral. There are some practices like Shin that are better at including families. I think that's one of the first things, is to look at how to have our spiritual recharging be something that is home-based. Another is to look at the indigenous cultures and think about pregnancy, birthing, lactating in a spiritual context. So in other words, indigenous cultures took pregnancy as a time of great psychic opening, and the pregnant woman was revered, and the pregnancy was seen as a spiritual practice. I think we can implement that in our day now, at this time, into Buddhism as well. It's a very... I don't know. How many of you have been pregnant? Okay. Do you remember how your dreams were? How sensitive you were? It's an opening of the veil to be pregnant. Well, that can be utilized for our spiritual development. So we need to tap into that. The act of giving birth is such a powerful initiation experience. And if it could be viewed as that, I think there would be a lot less postpartum depression, because it's very, very powerful. And we don't have a context to understand it through, we can feel very alone in our experience. And I have seen women after giving birth wide open spiritually. They have had a transformation. It is a transformation. So, once again, all of the religions, but for me, Buddhism is my practice, could really feminize our religions of origin by honoring and understanding more deeply the birthing experience as an initiation, as a powerful experience a woman goes through. So it moves both ways. It moves the way of taking the female experience of a female body with oxytocin, running through it, making us love and be mellow. I don't know if you remember nursing, and that, like, everything's cool feeling from nursing. That, and the insight into unconditional love that comes with all of the hormones, too, and the insight into unconditional love that comes from having given birth to our baby and seeing our baby for the first time, that is an spiritual opportunity as well that could be used to expand that unconditional love to all beings. So it's an opportunity that has sadly been missed. And just like, and like all spiritual transformations, anybody who's been to a workshop and had one knows, they kind of fade after a while. But if we take the ball and run with it, I think it's really exciting to think of what that would mean for the world, and for the woman who has given this gift of using of her body as a vessel for life. And then it moves the other way too, where Buddhism can really have, I don't know what the word is, practices that can be very, very useful to women, like allowing everything to be as it is, not seeking perfection. That's such a beautiful practice for mothers, because we want to do everything perfect for our children, and that's not possible. And if we start out with the premise that it's not possible, I think we could save ourselves a lot of angst. And to realize in a day when we're having a hard day and we're, not liking the things that are coming out of our mouth, that this is human, that we are human, that this is human, that this is all part of the process. And that's not a pink slip or whatever slip to, do anything goes. But mothers are, I work with mothers all the time, and they're hard on themselves. They're really hard on themselves. So this understanding of allowing things to be as they are, to accept our shadow and all, that we are enlightened underneath all of that, regardless of what the appearance looks like, can be very useful to for a mother to cultivate that awareness. And then back to what the experience of being a mother has to give to the practice. A mother is the paradigm of selfless service, and it is 24/7. So, Mother Teresa, she goes to sleep at night. Mother whoever is up like 6 times if the kid's throwing up, We're on when we're needed. It's such a rare spiritual opportunity for developing selfless service and egolessness. These are things every mother knows and goes through, but there's not been a light shed on it. There's not been a context for them to see it as highly spiritual activity. So, let's see. So I guess I would like to just say that the Buddha's teachings are tremendously helpful for mothers learning how to be present in the moment, mindful. Okay. That was a moment. To be present is to be understanding of impermanence, understanding of no self, understanding of suffering and the end of suffering, the Eightfold Path. All these things are of tremendous value. And I can't, there's not enough time, of course, to go into each one of these. But I just want to touch on it because I think it's a very exciting time to be a woman, to be a mother, to be any spiritual teacher, because it is, there's a whole new opening happening. And so I'm really, really grateful to be part of this. And so that's my, the work I do. And what I do is I have a foundation called the Hearth Foundation. And we teach for free in the Buddhist tradition. The teachings are given freely. We teach classes online for mothers on basic Buddhist principles, like there's a series on the three refuges, one on the five precepts. There's one on creating a shrine room, developing home-based spiritual practice. I have a series on death, dying, and illness for families, where we deal with issues like talking to children about death, Buddhist perspective of death, midwifing a death, dying loved one, and other issues that are pertinent to homemakers. I will talk about anything. There are no taboos. We'll talk about sexuality, about death, because my feeling is anything that's not talked about is apt to fester. So I think it's real healthy for families to talk about everything. And so we do that. And sometimes, like right now in my five precepts, one of the precepts is I will not misuse sexuality. So we're talking about, you know, everything, abortion, homosexuality, the whole thing. We, as families, we need to be open and talk about these things. It's in order to be healthy. So that's part of the Buddhist practice for families is open communication that we get from the psychology arena in the West. So that's what we do with Hearth. And trying to think if there's anything else that I should tell you about Hearth. I'm getting tea all over myself. That doesn't matter. So we're always developing new things. Like right now, I'm with the economy situation. We're working on developing support for living joyfully on less, simplifying our lives as families. So any issues that have to do with families, any issues that have to do with enlightenment, because I'm very engaged in my own practice now in enlightenment. And I also teach meditation through that. And we have students all over the world. So that's what I present to you. And I guess I'm just opening it up for any questions or discussion or anything you'd like to share.
Do you use the Metta Sutta as a template for the feminine presence in the Dhamma? You know, even as a mother protects with her life, her child, her only child, mm-hmm. so with a boundless heart she would cherish all living beings.
Right.
Because I've always found that to be very inspirational. And that's given as a universal teaching, both for women and for men, but it uses strongly feminine imagery. So I was wondering if that was...
It's so amazing that you mentioned that, Jim, because that is... I was given by one of the monks that was my teacher a little, one of those little Bodhi leaf pamphlets on the teachings of loving kindness and the Metta Sutta. It was the first 30 years ago thing I was given. And it is the basis of Buddha Mom and of all the work I do. It is the, like you nailed it. That is the basis of the work. It's about loving kindness. And, you know, I've kind of gotten into other realms, and I do teach the Brahma Viharas. But, you know, it's really nice to be reminded of that, because it is, that is the mothering practice, is the Metta Sutta. Yeah, thank you.
I wonder if you have any insight. One thing I've noticed as you travel in Buddhist circles, particularly the I'm most familiar, the ones around here, you have Jisho Warner, you've got Dr. Tim, Spirit Rocks, about half their teachers are women. Come to most any Buddhist gathering, and it's, I think it used to be half men and women, but mm-hmm. now I think it's edging more towards two-thirds women, uh-huh. one-third men. The Buddhist Peace Fellowship, just their executive director now is an African-American woman. You think of major authors like Pema Chodron. Everywhere in the West, women seem not only not absent or hard to find, but prominent.
Yeah.
So my question is, do you have insight as to why you think that is?
I have a little interesting thing to add to that. I mean, I know what you're saying. I experience that too. In Taiwan and in Korea, where women are allowed to be bhikkhunis, in Thailand right now, well, there's a whole situation going, but the only males are allowed to be spiritual teachers. So that's a whole other talk sometime, but I'm like in the middle of that whole thing. But even in Thailand, most of the people who feed the monks and who do the worship are women. And so it does. In those countries, it's mostly women. Mostly women monks in Taiwan and in Korea, more than men. And in Thailand, they're like really scared of that happening to them, so they're just not allowing women to be monks. I don't know why that is. It's an interesting question. But it's not just the West. If it was just the West, I'd have a glib answer for you, like, well, it's because, you know, women are finally, you know, have the... But it's not... There's something about women being hungrier for the teachings, or more receptive, and I really don't know what the answer is, but I know what you're saying, and I've experienced that at all kinds of spiritual gatherings, not just Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And Joyce Joyce is a minister, assistant minister at the Church of Religious Science in Santa Rosa, and there's a lot of women in...
Probably more of our ministers are women. Mm-hmm. And one reason is, I would imagine, is, you know, anytime you have a situation that is receptive to women developing their spirituality, they will rush in, because it has historically been denied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have a comment to make about Korea. When I was in Korea, I'm a monastic in Korea, and there are quite a few more Buddhist nuns in Korea than there are Buddhist monks, and I asked my teacher about that, and he said that his answer was that for a woman to become a monastic in Korea was a much bigger decision than for a man to become a monastic. And it had to do with the sociology. I don't know how universally this is applicable, but I'm just offering it for consideration. He said that if a man decided to become a monk and then decides to return to lay life, they're usually accepted back by the family. You know, like, but if a woman decides to become a nun and then changes her mind, the family usually does not accept her back.
You know, like, interesting.
Or it's more difficult for her. That is to say, the family will view the woman returning as a burden, you know, like, rather than an opportunity to mm-hmm. expand the family name or through marriage and that kind of thing. So that his view was that Korean
Buddhist nuns were much more dedicated, much more focused, and much more serious because they had to consider what they were doing more, you know, more deeply before they entered that vocation. So I'm just passing that along for consideration.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I think in most Asian countries, women are a burden to the family in a sense of where the man is like carries on the business and gets the inheritance. A girl, you have to wed her off to somebody and pay her dowry, and you know, it's kind of traditionally how it's been. But it's interesting because here in America it's not like that, and you're saying, and I experience the same thing too, that you know, a lot of women.
Well, I had a question because we're talking about monastic practice, and that, you know, Buddhism is traditionally a home leaving practice.
Right.
And there, of course, when these practices and teachings came to the West, and I was very much a part of it in the early 70s, the emphasis was on the long retreats and the, you know, long periods of meditation, and that would bring you to enlightenment. And so I understand and totally applaud your work in trying to take these practices and set them in a more secular setting. But I'm still having a little trouble seeing the jump.
Yes.
In the sense of, you know, in your work with women, how much emphasis is put on retreat, on meditation, mm-hmm. on that time where you are not mother or father,
right.
or daughter.
Right,
or sister.
The absolute.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is something I'm very concerned with. I really am like advocating and supporting a daily meditation practice for all of my students. And I have been bending over backwards to try and get them to have a consistent, even just 5 minutes a day to turn within. I was just in Colorado with Sarah Harding, who is do you know Sarah Harding's work? She's a Tibetan translator, and I asked her this question about you know, women actually becoming enlightened in their homes. So going the full thing, you know, not just like becoming mindful and stuff, but actually crossing over. And she said, well, Machik Lobdrum did, you know, she had children, but she said, you know, I don't know if it translates. and I said to her at the time, I said, yeah, maybe not. But then I thought afterwards, just because it hasn't been done does not mean it's not possible. And there is not a tradition for becoming enlightened within the home. We don't have stories of women. We have stories of people going on retreats and becoming enlightened. But you don't need to go on a retreat unless it's the only way to achieve understanding of the absolute and to cross over. I'll just call it crossover. And so this is a question that I am deeply in the middle of now. I am studying with every teacher I can to find ways that we can experience and practice the absolute in the middle of the home. Because, no, they can't go on retreats. It's a real hardship for a mother to go on a retreat. Once in a while they can, you know, but it's expensive, and you have to have child care, and if you have little ones, it's really hard. So I think it's great if women can. I was able to go on retreats when my daughter was a baby because it was a priority for me. But not everybody can pull it off. So my search question, if you will, is what you're saying. I don't have a yes or no, I have a, I kind of think it's possible to do it not on retreats, to go just as far and just as deep into the spiritual practice. But I'm still in the exploration, discovery phase of that. And that's not to downgrade going on retreats, because I think it's, you know, to build up that concentration and mindfulness on a retreat is something that I've really valued in my own practice and life. But I'm looking at the question, and I don't have an answer. Is that the only way to do it? So that's where I'm with that. I'm in the question. You'll have to call me back like in a few years, and I'll come and talk with
you. You're welcome at any time.
Thanks, Jim. But that's a really important question, blending the absolute and the relative. You know, the relative is being mindful every day, developing loving kindness in a day-to-day activity. The absolute is experiencing that state where there is no male or female, where there is no the non-dual state of emptiness. So, we'll see.
Well, one thing you said right in the beginning, I always think of it that the Buddha always thought of the three jewels of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. He said that Sangha was the most important,
mm-hmm.
because the support of the fellow practitioners was a huge, it was a huge support.
Absolutely.
And what you're trying to do is really beautiful, but it doesn't have a lot of
support. It does have Sangha. We're a Sangha. Mm-hmm. We do it online. Mm-hmm. I did not know, I've been doing it for 5 years, I did not know if it would create Sangha or not, because like we have somebody in Venezuela and somebody in Ireland and somebody in Canada, and but they're forming Sangha. They're actually doing what a Sangha does, which is support one another's spiritual practice. And yet they don't have, a lot of them, like I have students in the middle of the Bible Belt. There aren't any Buddhist facilities there. They need Sanghas, but and so there are other ways to do Sangha besides an actual physical space. We're living in a whole new era. So I'm not saying that physical Sangha isn't important and that it isn't wonderful, but that's not always possible. And just like with retreats, it's not always possible. It's wonderful if you can have it. But I have my students are people who don't have it. Even ones who have Sanghas nearby, to actually have them support their spiritual practice with their children and everything like that is rare. So, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And Sangha can be created in a lot of different new ways. Yeah.
I was interested to hear more about making a home a safe place, because it seems like that really relates to that question. It's almost like that sounds like it might be the key. If you can come to some kind of really radically different understanding of how you make your home and relate to your home, you can make that the place where that movement to the absolute is supported.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering what specific things.
Well, you know, it's,
make that happen.
You know, something interesting about Sangha? Some of my students are making their families into Sanghas. They all meditate together. That's Sangha, you know, whether two or more are together, and you know. In Buddhist countries, all homes have shrine areas, and Shin religion has a very home-based spiritual practice that's very strong. I think that having a space that where there's a visual reminder of the practice is really helpful in developing the practice in the home. The children see it. We're coming into a whole new... When I was growing up in Buddhism, children weren't involved in it very much. I know John Terrence and his group had children actually coming to retreats and stuff, but that's like really rare. But I think that by having something actually set up in the home, the children are asking questions and becoming involved. Part of home-based practice is sharing it with your family and doing that through books and doing that through stories and meditating with your children and teaching them meditation and all sorts of ways. And I'm not sure if that's what you're getting at, though, Sandy.
Well, I'm not sure it is either. I mean, it just sounded so provocative to home. And I think there are some Sangha answers in there too, because Sangha can include non-human parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And if you're sort of cut off from the usual sources of Sangha, besides the wonderful mm-hmm. Cyberspace Sangha, there's also, I think, if you can begin to see, you know, the squirrel that's running across your roof, or mm-hmm. even the teapot that you're washing, if you begin to count all of it mm-hmm. as beings,
yeah.
then you have a context for not just the mindfulness and not just the loving kindness, but the whole kit caboodle.
Mm-hmm.
Right there.
Mm-hmm.
And if whatever form of Sangha you have, you know, the more traditional sense of the contact, you have the support from other people in the practice, if that's shared. So it's not, when I came out with Dharma Family Treasures, it was because we were all looking for how does this fit. And it's sort of not enough that, well, maybe if you can go on a retreat, the practice that's addressed is disconnected from the diapers and the whining.
Mm-hmm.
You need something that's really engaged with what you're doing and to be able to see that as a vehicle.
That's what we're doing at Hearth. That's exactly what we're doing. We're experimenting with having the things we do, like using like when you're driving, you're doing all your errands, using a red light as a mindfulness object. When you're, choiceless awareness, all these things. We're like this little laboratory. I see us as a laboratory because we don't have the answers. This is so new, you know? It's just in this century, the 20th century, you know, that it's, and it's even toward the end, it's brand new. So we don't have the answers, but I think all of that is really relevant. And one of the things I do with my Shrine Room class is I have the mothers go out, take a walk with the children, and pick flowers or stones or sticks or whatever to create something of beauty on the shrine, on the altar, and to talk about impermanence, you know, because if you have a flower, it's a wonderful opportunity to talk with children about impermanence. The original Ikebana was Zen monks teaching through flower arrangement. And one of the teachings I remember was there's an arrangement with one tight bud, one opening flower, and one fully open flower. And it's a teaching on impermanence. And some of my students have said, you know, the kids come and they take out the flowers and they see that they're dying, and it gives them an opportunity to talk about impermanence. So I think ritual has been used by all religions, and I think that it's very useful to have in-home practice, to have ritual, whether it's saying grace, whether it's sitting to meditate in the morning, whatever it is, that's part of making a home temple, is having rituals in the temple. And having visual reminders of the practice is very, very helpful. And I'm really adamant with my students that, remember, these are just reminders of principles, not to get attached to it being a real thing. You know what I mean? Because we humans want to make worship into, we want to make idols and stuff. You know? So, but I think it's, I think we can, as Buddhist families, can draw from the other religions a lot for making home-centered practice. You know, the Jews have Sabbath on Friday night. It's a beautiful spiritual practice that the whole family engages in. And saying grace and thanksgiving. You know, all these are opportunities for Buddhist families to... and this is what, whenever Buddhism goes somewhere, it takes what the culture did and it reinterprets it, huh? So we take Christmas and we take Christmas and we reinterpret it as an opportunity to do teachings on generosity for our children. So we focus more on giving than on what we're going to get. And, you know, and I'm mad the beauty of it all and everything. So we're commandeering the American practices, and that's whenever a new religion enters a culture, that's what they do. So I feel justified.
I'm really excited about looking at the natural experience, the powerful transforming experiences that women have, and spiritualizing them. As you mentioned, the idea of really looking at the opening that is birth. Because, I mean, looking back now, 27 years, I realize what you mentioned about unconditional love and how it was impacting not only me, but my husband. And how when I returned to work 4 months later, I just had so much more empathy for people because of that little being. And I'm just excited about the idea of really, for want of a better word, capitalizing on that.
Yeah.
And spiritualizing it.
Yeah. And how wonderful for the mothers, because, you know, I remember after giving birth, I was like, whoa,
yeah,
what was that?
You
know, it was like, yow, you know, it's a huge experience.
Yeah.
And so often women are left alone in the, and everything's supposed to be cute and pink all of a sudden. What the hell is cute and pink?
Yeah.
You just went through life and death and, you know what I mean? It's like, whoa. So I think it really would be so useful on so many levels to deepen the understanding of what pregnancy is and explore it and use it for spiritual gain.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, capitalizing, I have no problem with that.
I do, but I do feel like the indigenous cultures at least can reflect that culture. And we don't have any reflection of that in our communities, in our wider communities and cultures, and that, so that is a beautiful movement that I would love to see happen in a wider sense, and I must say, feel pretty at loss of how that movement could spread.
I'll tell you how it could spread. Yes, I will. I'll tell you right now. And I've got some oil for you here. No. It spreads by talking about it, by writing about it, by singing about it. You know, it's like just, you know, you talk about it. And anybody who's given birth goes, yeah. But we haven't talked about it. We haven't. It's new literature to do this, but it's starting to come out. And there is a little bit of precedence from the hippies, Thank God for my sisters. When I was pregnant, I found a book called Spiritual Midwifery. Do you know that, Jeff?
By Ina May
Gaskin. Ina May Gaskin was one hell of a pioneer.
Did you know that half of those women who gave birth on the farm live in Sebastopol?
Really?
And wow. Her friends, her husband was the doctor who, Dr. Herderman, was the one who gave the medical support so that they could do a birth.
Wow. Oh, gotta love Sebastopol. That woman turned my head around because she was the only one I could find writing about this powerful transformative experience called pregnancy and birth, you know, and she had, that was the, I like ate that book when I was pregnant. I was, you know, it,
but you know
it's
what
beautiful.
Other women are doing now. I mean, it's interesting because I come from that era, and many of my colleagues are having grandchildren, you know, and they're their daughters and daughters-in-law who are giving birth, and they have this wonderful idea of the spiritual birth and this, and their daughters and daughters-in-law are scheduling their births. Mm-hmm. They're being induced on a certain date so that they can get back to work as quickly as possible.
Yeah, that's. But you know, a movement doesn't happen in a linear fashion, huh? She really made some headway, and there's a lot more work to do. And the dominant culture goes totally against everything I'm talking about here today. So, you know, we've got our work cut out for us. Mm-hmm. And so let's get to work, you know. It's like I'm encouraging all of my students, write your experiences. You know, everybody I can encourage to do this because it's two steps forward, one step back, you know? And my daughter gave birth in the birthing center here in Santa Rosa. And, but she wasn't into the whole, you know, she thinks it's, you know, kids have to individuate from their parents and stuff like that. So there's some of that going on too. But, it unfolds in a mysterious fashion, and we just have to keep doing the research and writing our findings and talking with each other.
When you mentioned, you know, the need to individuate from the parents, just this sort of one generation finally getting it and the next one losing it, I'm thinking this might be another area where we could look to indigenous cultures for some clues, because they're able to have that more sacred experience of birth, and the daughter doesn't rebel against that. You know, mm-hmm. she takes that in,
right.
And it's really fast. And not only to look at the sacred attitude toward pregnancy, but look at how the attitude of passing things along rather than breaking with them.
Right.
Each generation, we might be able to learn something about this story.
It's the best place to go for spiritual information, whether it's for an aging woman, you know, their attitude toward aging and the wisdom that comes with it, and the honor and respect, or birthing it, they're much more sensible than Western conditioned culture. So, yeah, it's a good place to go for.
And for making
for that.
Home sacred, too.
Yeah. 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 But we are going to have to interpret it for 21st century. So we need to, there's a danger in getting too retro, and then it's not really.
It's not that retro. They're here working on the same
thing. Yeah. I know. But the taking that and translating it to somebody who has to drive a car, whose child is exposed to, you know, sexually explicit ads, and who's lives in this capitalistic culture, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's a real puzzle. It's a real puzzle, and I believe that there's ways to make the pieces fit together. And I think that's a really important piece, is learning from our indigenous sisters and brothers. I think that's really important. And just looking, I look in every religion, what works, you know? And different religions have different pieces of it, you know? So Judaism is very family-oriented, and they have some wonderful things that can inform the Buddhist family, you know? Dalai Lama invited a bunch of Jews to, and I'm a Jew, so I'm going to call them Jews, to teach, how did your people learn to live in exile? Because now he has a nation in exile. So, you know.
Didn't you remember his answer? It was very funny. He said, oh, well, we brought it into the home and we had them participate, and the children seemed to really be engaged. He says, oh, well, at our ceremonies, the children just fall asleep.
Which one said they fell asleep?
The Dalai Lama. All this long, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, you got to shape something for that's going to work, you know, and you got to make a lot of mistakes and be willing to throw stuff out and try something new. It's a creative process, you know, to create something like this. And you got to just be totally, as Ernest Holmes says, open at the top. Which, you know, just anything, just learn from anything and anybody, whatever works. Just be a spiritual slut, you know?
Yeah, that's what I want.
Yeah, I thought, I woke you two up. I was aiming at that. Yeah. But, yeah, you know, just like... yeah, so the Jewish family had to bring it into the home. And so they have a lot, they're very home-based. And I don't know what's going to happen with monks and nuns in the foreseeable future. I think it's wonderful to have that option for somebody to totally go forth. I also think that teachers who have families sometimes understand the needs of families in a different kind of a way. So I don't know. But I'm in the middle of this whole what's going on in Thailand with nuns and stuff like that. So I've been thinking about, wow, is it a dying thing, monasticism, or is it not? I don't know. But anyway, yeah.
Do you see any crossovers with shamanistic practices?
How so?
Well, it seems to me that the maybe I need to back up a whole step and think that when Tara declined the invitation, she was being very politically adept, because the way I see it is that women have an inherent advantage over men anyway, because they have a certain experiences in life that you've talked about tonight that not only ground them, it gives them a very earth-centered access to spiritual, mm-hmm. which pervades it all, but men usually abstract from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of think, well, it's almost as if women didn't need it, all the men needed to be studying this because they didn't get it. But they fled into the mind. But the shamanistic practices, it seems to me, I was reading an interview with Rabbi Gershon Winkler, who was a shamanistic rabbi, and it strikes me that there are lots of ways that would support what you're doing that seem to be absolutely devoid of any sexism,
mm-hmm.
And they're very rooted in being present, as is Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
But also very connected with the natural world, as you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I'd be real interested to I'll write down his name and look into that. That sounds really interesting. Yeah. That's an interesting thing, the difference between men and women and how men have commandeered spirituality as, you know, in charge of the whole thing and turned it into institutions and stuff like that. And I think both are important. I mean, I think the the male energy is just as important as the female energy in spirituality and in keeping it alive, and the desire to build organizations and the Abhidhamma and the, you know, mental peace. It just needs balance. I don't think it needs elimination. I think it needs balance. It's just too top heavy. It's too, you know, I totally agree. We need to bring it, the earth and the sky, together in balance. Right now it's like this, and we need to bring it in balance.
Too young.
Yeah.
It's coming. Well, you can see it in all.
Oh, well, yes.
In the past 500 years, we've gone as far as we can, it seems, in one direction.
Yeah. It's coming, and we are at the epicenter, my friend, here in Sebastopol. Really and truly, I talked to my friend who lives up in Bellingham, Washington, and I said, I just did an intensive with Ajahn Shante. Do you know who he is?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's an incredible teacher. He's an amazing teacher, just of awakening. That's his whole teaching, and he is phenomenal. And she said, you know, I miss being in the Bay Area for that reason, because you have these teachers there. We are just blessed with amazing teachers in this area. He doesn't do much teachings outside of the Bay Area. So, yeah. Well, is there anything else anybody wanted to further explore? I got to tell you, this is like just such a treat for me, because a lot of times when I give talks, because I teach mothering as a spiritual practice, they ask me questions about how to discipline their children. And I have to say, listen, I don't know how to discipline your child. I teach enlightenment. I don't know. You know, it's like, I guess it's the Reaganomics trickle down thing. You know, you become enlightened and it trickles down. To be politically incorrect.
You can't count on that with kids, though. It might have to trickle up.
It goes both directions.
Right.
And both economics as well, but we won't get into that. I won't give you a Sarah Palin moment. I almost brought some black glasses with me, but I don't think I can pull it off too well. But anyway, thank you so much for coming out. Feel free to take pamphlets. And thank you for sharing this journey with me.
Thank you, Debbie.